Now, we had a very strong reaction to our interview last week on the show with Brendan Lyon, the chief executive of the think tank Infrastructure Partnerships Australia. This seems to have raised the ire of many of you.
I think we really need to get back to the basics, which is if we can't borrow more within credit ratings, if government can't borrow more in terms of going out and taxing the economy, then really we have to look at what are the things that we own that would be better owned by somebody else to free up the money. It's just like anyone else in terms of taking on additional borrowings. If we haven't got room in the revenue, if we're not willing to make savings in what we spend each year, then we do need to find the money in the assets that we already have.
Well, straight away I received text messages asking for economist John Quiggin from the University of Queensland to return to the program to discuss whether state governments should sell off assets to fund other infrastructure spends. Timely this week, given that we've also had the announcement from South Australia that they're going to go it alone, and while they are working with the private sector on battery storage, that's quite an extraordinary story that, the government will also build a taxpayer-funded gas-fired power plant, as you heard discussed on AM, supplying energy to their state and overriding national energy market rules. So we'll ask John about this as well. Welcome, John.
Good morning.
What piqued our interest in this whole infrastructure investment story were reports of the flood of overseas private investment funds competing to invest in projects like the WestConnex motorway in Sydney and, say, the North East Link project proposed in Melbourne. Now, you say in your critique that this is contrary to what private-public partnerships, PPPs, were supposed to be modelled on in the first place. Now, what are you getting at there?
Well, there isn't a flood of private money eager to invest in these projects. In fact, in both these cases, it's the government who's had to invest in the projects because the private-public partnership model, which used to apply, has broken down completely.
So when would you say it broke down?
Well, in two stages. The first deals done in the 1990s were incredibly profitable for the investors, but not great for the public. Then we saw a bunch of deals, the Lane Cove Tunnel, Airport Link Tunnel in Brisbane and so forth, in which the private investors lost their shirts. And what we've seen is that it's been impossible to produce a bargain in which the public gets good value for money and the private sector gets an adequate return on its capital. So we've seen the old PPP model break down. Now what we're seeing with these two projects you mentioned, with the NBN, with recent interventions in electricity, is the government stepping in to do the risky stuff. Then, of course, once the road is built and the tolls are flowing in a nice steady basis, then certainly the private sector is happy to buy the monopoly asset and collect the returns. But what we've seen is that they're not willing to take the risks associated with the investment, and that's actually very sensible. These risks are risks that really belong with society as a whole and not with the owners of some particular piece of infrastructure.
And so there's no sharing in these new arrangements, but you've obviously looked at them closely?
Well, I mean, there's complicated shares, but the key point is that a large amount of government money and, of course, public money in the form of toll revenue is what's making both WestConnex and the North East Victorian Road project happen. Whereas in the past, these projects were supposed to be privately financed, the private sector was supposed to take that risk.
Would you also say that if government wants to basically get new projects built, and I might add, people like the Reserve Bank Governor Ian Lowe said the other day that he wanted governments to spend more on, say, transportation infrastructure or risk social unrest. What do you think he's getting at there? What's at stake here?
Well, the basic point is that because of this obsession with keeping debt levels down, the public sector has been unwilling to invest. And so even with these latest projects, we're seeing an attempt to keep them off the books as much as possible. What the governor is saying and a wide range of commenters are saying is that the public sector has an immense capacity to borrow money at very, very low rates of interest. We should be using that capacity.
And why aren't we? I mean, governments clearly don't want to go out of office. There is an argument that this played a role, possibly even a significant role in WA, though it's very hard to tease this out. It certainly is worrying the Queensland government played a role in Anna Bligh's departure. How can governments then persuade the public that this is worthwhile?
Well, the public isn't the problem. It's the political class that's the problem. The public has repeatedly thrown out, as you just said, the governments that have tried to sell off public assets to the private, that have failed to deliver infrastructure, that have gone into these deals. What we have is a political establishment, including Infrastructure Australia and bodies like that, who are absolutely convinced that we need to get the government out of this business.
Do they have nothing on their side? You don't favour any of their arguments?
Well, I mean, obviously there are. There's a lot of arguments out there, so I'm not going to give a blanket rejection. But certainly what you see is a bunch of fundamental misunderstandings which have really driven bad policy across the whole infrastructure sector. We've seen, of course, in telecommunications, again, the idea was that there was a flood of private sector money was going to come in and build broadband for us. Instead, the government had to step in and do the job.
Yes, I saw Alan Kohler writing about that the other day. One of Brendan Lyon's arguments, of course, John, was that where governments can persuade their public that it's worth it and stare down vested interests, like, say, unions, they actually can get new infrastructure off the ground, which will ultimately, they say, benefit their citizens, particularly in the large urban centres. And that where you don't see it, you see log jams. Isn't there a case to be made for that?
No, there isn't. There's no relationship between selling one asset and investing in another.
Well hang on. When you say there surely is some, but you don't like the link, wouldn't that be a fair way to put it?
There's a link being drawn by, as you say, vested interests, namely the financial sector in this, because they benefit greatly from the sales. But there's no sense in which selling off assets in one part of the economy provides an additional capacity to invest in another part. And that's particularly true with the so-called asset recycling, if, as is almost always the case, a number of the new investments do not generate an income. So this is very much like selling off your share portfolio and buying a luxury car. You can do it once, and if you want to, you can call it asset recycling, but it can't be done twice. You look at the proceeds of many of the New South Wales privatisations, and they've gone into projects which are very worthwhile in many ways, but which don't generate any income at all. So those assets cannot be sold a second time.
Oh, so that's your yardstick, is it? Would you say that that's good and bad debt territory, as it were, that governments always ought to be able to see a revenue stream from what they sell off?
No, I'm not saying that that's necessary. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case. I'm merely saying that the pitch we're being given makes it sound as if this can be repeated, when in fact it's a once-off transaction where we sell off an income-generating asset and effectively spend the proceeds. That actually requires further taxation revenue down the track, because we've lost the income stream. What we replace it with has nothing. And so what's being offered is a spurious something for nothing. It doesn't mean, of course, that what's being invested in is a bad idea. It may well be. It's just that it will have to be supported out of tax revenue.
Or by people paying, a user pays.
Well, as I say, in the assets I'm talking about, typically things like revitalising the centre of Newcastle, which I'm sure is a great idea, there isn't a stream of user pays to be had, and that's typical of these asset recycling ideas that have been proposed.
Now, of course, what seems to really get up the nose of a lot of consumers and voters is that they feel they will be left holding the baby by higher prices, and that certainly played a role in terms of the WA election, in terms of electricity pricing and so on. Now, do you think consumers are right there, or are they seeing very short-term disadvantage and failing to see the longer-term advantage?
Well, this is a complicated story, and your previous guest gave a very misleading account of it, but because there's a whole bunch of processes going on with something like electricity, of which privatisation is only a relatively minor part. Really, the whole thing is the creation of the national electricity market, the corporatisation, whether or not there's subsequent privatisation of monopoly enterprises, and the rates of return that are being allocated to those enterprises. But the overall effect has been, again, contrary to what your guest had to say, massively increasing prices everywhere in Australia, whether or not privatisation has taken place. So in this context, privatisation is more a problem as it's an obstacle in bringing the system back under control than as a source directly of rising prices.
Yes, I noticed that was obviously the Grattan Report's work this week called Price Shock, is the retail electricity market failing consumers? And I noticed the ACCC came out last week talking about the privatisation of the Brisbane, Melbourne and Sydney airports into monopoly hands, of course, that it had increased revenues per passenger. So why do governments persist in doing this, John? That's my question, if it's proving to be as disadvantageous as you say.
Clearly, there's two elements. One is a sort of general ideological element that people have been saturated by the beliefs going back to the 80s and 90s about microeconomic reform, and again, your guest referred to that. And the other is that we have in Australia a political career structure in which really privatising an asset is a very good career move. If you look at the people who've carried through successful privatisations in office and see what they're doing now, you'll find that the vast majority of them are working in highly paid positions in financial institutions.
Oh, John, you really mean that?
Yes. I think it's absolutely clear that people go into politics now very young and they're looking for a post-political career. I think people are aware of these things.
So if, in your ideal world then, governments would now, state governments, we're talking about primarily, I suppose, would be borrowing with these low interest rates, as you say, and what, this would be like a long-term mortgage, such that we take out all the time, and would governments then run these things, or would they try to set up competitive markets, which is what I think the Grattan was sort of saying, there isn't enough competitive marketplace, and so people are able to raise charges and possibly even gouge. So what's your ideal outcome?
Well, I mean, this depends very much on the structure of the industry in question. I mean, a lot of what happened with the reform of telecommunications, electricity and so forth was a relatively naive faith in competition that was supposed to overcome the natural monopoly features of these activities. We really only need one national broadband network. We really need only one electricity distribution and transmission system. And when you have those things, there isn't really, as the Grattan report has found, a huge amount of benefit to consumers in having competition among retailers because the service that's being provided really is a fairly straightforward service that can't be varied very much by making a different deal with the retailers.
So can you imagine this being electorally sold well and that a government involved would not threaten their credit rating by doing something like this?
Well, we'll deal with the credit rating first. I mean, the credit rating is an obsession of the political class, but there's no reason why we should be paying huge amounts of attention to it. Objectively, a lower credit rating means you pay a tiny premium on borrowing, which is more than offset by the fact that you can invest these things in assets that return far more than the interest cost of borrowing. And we can look, these things are just swamped by movements in interest rates. So countries with very poor credit ratings are borrowing at much lower cost than AAA countries were borrowing a few years ago. So the credit rating, I think, is an obsession of the political class, but it doesn't play much with the public because they recognise that this is a judgment by bond agencies, not a very accurate judgment of what's in their interest, not what's in the interest of the public. Looking at could this be done, well, there isn't, as far as I'm aware, much public opinion on renationalisation in Australia. But if you go to the UK, which was the home of this stuff, 20 years after the major privatisations of the Thatcher government, there's majority support for renationalising most of those enterprises. So I think the public support is out there. I mean, it's certainly true that we would have a big scare campaign from vested interests, as you mentioned, the vested interests of the banking industry and ideological vested interests. But there's nothing to suggest that it couldn't be done.
John Quiggin, I knew it'd be bracing, and it was. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
And John's a professor, an economist, and a Research Council Laureate Fellow at the University of Queensland.
That feeling you get when you realise the moon used to be so much closer that it lit up the night sky as bright as an office?
When you realise that there's an object out there that wouldn't just rip you apart, it would erase your very existence?
When you realise there could be alien life swimming in the oceans on a nearby moon?
That feeling you get when you realise that the sun is only 20 galactic years old and will be dead by the time it's 40?
That's what we call cosmic vertigo. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.